can encourage you to open your Bibles, if you haven't already, at Leviticus 23, because we're going to look at that, but also some other there's going to be some other things to look at as well, so it'll be useful to have it open. So this morning, this is our last in the series of looking at Leviticus, and the reading we've is part of the last four chapters, which talk about all the festivals to God. And so we're going to look mainly at the ones we've read, but also at some of the others. And when Sean first mentioned we were doing Leviticus, I probably shouldn't confess this, but I did sort of think, oh, crikey, here we go. And then when I put down which weeks I was available, and when I got given this one, I was like, I have won the jackpot. Because if you read through these four chapters, the first, the most obvious message is, have a rest, have a party. You could sum them up that way. God commands his people to rest. Once a week, stop and rest. God commands his people to gather together and celebrate all sorts of things. So we heard read the Passover, which obviously is the big one, the kind of the rescue of them from Egypt. But we also read in verses 9 to 14, they have a celebration at the start of the harvest. If you carry on, there's one at the end of the harvest. If you thought that Glastonbury or Woodstock or even Spring Harvest was a modern phenomenon, you would be wrong. As you go through the Festival of Tabernacles, there is a week-long camping festival. And in a bizarre twist that I did not see coming, it would seem that God might be Welsh, because he appears to think that brass music is the best. There is literally a trumpet festival. They have a trust festival and they play trumpets. That's it. That's what they do. As Sean mentioned in one of the earlier sermons, there are different kinds of laws and commands in Leviticus, and we don't necessarily just go, oh, they did that, we'll do that. It's not quite as straightforward as that. Although I am very, as a person of Welsh heritage, very up for bringing back the trumpet festival. I think we could go further. A whole brass band would be great. But we can't therefore also go, oh, well, that was then and this is now, and we'll write it off. We need to look into it more deeply and see what we learn about God's character, about his priorities, about his desires for his people, because we are his people. And what we find is wisdom that transcends culture. And the first thing, as I kind of delved more into it, that runs through these chapters, and indeed through the book of Leviticus, is the thread of God's provision for his people. It's really easy to read Leviticus as a list of you must do this, you must do this, you mustn't do that, you must do this, don't do that, do this. It's very easy to read it like that, but that's a very sort of superficial reading. We need to look at God's intent. Verse 3, rest every week. God commands us to rest, have a day of not working. Isn't that something we need more than ever in our eternally connected world that never switches off, with endless television, total connection to the internet all the time? Do we not need to hear that loving command to rest? And not just us, the land needs to rest. Later on, God commands a Sabbath year where they're not to plant any crops. And we now know, on a scientific basis, that land that is endlessly, repeatedly cultivated gets exhausted and becomes less fruitful. So in that command to give the land a rest, God is ensuring their ongoing ability to grow crops. It's his provision. Verse 4 onward, God commands them to have feasts, to get together and celebrate. He ordains community connectedness. And there is a weekly, daily, annual rhythm to this. The seventh month, which would have been their harvest time, the end of their harvest time, has more festivals and Sabbaths than any other month. And I just think that's lovely. If I've never been a farmer, but if you are a farmer, the harvest is manic. You are desperately trying to get all your crops in as fast as you can before the rain turns up again. You will work really, really long hours. It will be really, really tiring. It's a really frenetic period of activity. And once that's over, God says, have some more rest. Get together. Be together. And that is God's mercy, his provision, his love for his people. As the chapters go on, there's the year of Jubilee, which was a limit to escalating wealth or poverty. In that time, if you hit hard times and you couldn't afford to farm your land, you ran out of money, you could sell your land and you could sell yourself into slavery. But every 50 years, there was a jubilee year. All outstanding debts were to be written off. So if you'd lent someone money and they haven't finished paying it back, you wrote it off. If you had put yourself into slavery, you were set free. If your land had been sold, the person who bought it had to give it back. And we might find it hard to understand the importance of land, but if you're a subsistence farmer and you have no land, you have nothing, you have no way of eating. And there's no way out of it. But once in a generation, everyone reset. So whether you'd struggled or done really well, God provides a way to stop poverty and indeed wealth escalating. There is a generosity of provision for everyone in that, and a radical approach that might make us think differently about taxation, for one thing. And the evidence is that Israel never lived up to that command for the Jubilee year. But it's very telling about what it says to us about God's priorities, his view of our money, our wealth, and our approach to those who have less than we do. So the first thing, as I read through these chapters, is you see God's provision, his goodness, his kindness, bound up in them. But we are missing something vital if we stop there and think, oh, okay, this is just God's way to have a good life. When we look at what he commands, there is a much deeper purpose. And I don't know if you find it hard to imagine what it would be like to literally live off what you grow. We are at such a remove from that. We had a minor taste of it in COVID when we couldn't get everything we wanted, and I felt like I spent hours trying to find flour. But that is nothing compared to how they were living. You grew your crops, you looked after your animals. If they got ill and died, you didn't have them to breed from, you wouldn't be able to eat them. If the rain didn't come at the right time, your crops would fail. You might have locusts that would come in and wipe them out, and then you had nothing. Nothing. And in that context, God says, once a week, stop and rest. Every week. Doesn't matter whether it's harvest time, doesn't matter whether it's sunny today, but you can see the rain clouds coming. Once a week on the Sabbath, you need to stop. Now, if you've watched Clarkson's Farm, whatever you think about Jeremy Clarkson, the one thing that is very clear is that desperate battle to fight the weather, get the crops in, look after the animals effectively. It's really hard work, and you wouldn't want to waste a sunny day. So that's quite a strange command. And then we read about the festival of the first fruits. And again, if you're a subsistence farmer, you are waiting for that harvest. Your stocks are dwindling. You might be down to your last turnip. You are hanging on for the wheat to be ready to harvest and you can make fresh bread again. And God says to them, bring me the first. Bring me the first sheaf of wheat that you harvest and bring me the best. Bring me a lamb without defect and the finest flour. Not the bit that you've got left over that wasn't too good. The first and the best. And then he says, give the whole land a year off. That would be terrifying. You can't plant anything. You can just eat what grows. The Israelites, like the countries around them, depended on their land. But God is saying, he's calling them to radically, in a concrete way, that impacts daily life, to depend on him first. Stopping every week on the same day, regardless of the weather or the demands of your crops. Consecrate that day to God. When the long-awaited harvest rolls in, give the very first part to God. It says that's in a very tangible, visceral way, we don't depend on the gifts, we depend on the giver. In the Jubilee year, let go of the wealth you've accumulated. Give back the land you bought. Forgive any unpaid debts. That's not very capitalist, is it? Because God commands you to. God calls us to deep dependence on him above all things. A few chapters on, God says this, observe my Sabbaths. Have reverence for my sanctuary. I am the Lord. If you follow my decrees and are careful to obey my commands, I will send you rain in its season. The ground will yield its crops and the trees their fruit. Your threshing, I don't know what threshing is, but it sounds important, will continue until grape harvest, and the grape harvest will continue until planting, and you will eat all the food you want and live in safety in your land. Do you see the order? Not work really hard, try and make as much as you can. Observe my Sabbaths, have reverence for my sanctuary, follow my commands, and I will provide for you. Trust me, not the land. Now, the danger of this is that if we take a superficial dive over it, it's very easy to justify some sort of prosperity gospel. Follow God and be wealthy. But this was written to people who were currently refugees. They were wandering in the wilderness with nothing except God hopefully providing manna every day. They were not safe. They had escaped from slavery, and they had nothing and nowhere to belong. And God is saying to them, I will give you safety and I will give you food. But there is more to it than that even, and we'll come back to that later. But what he's saying to them is, when you get to that land, don't mistake the land for the thing that keeps you safe. Remember, it's me. It's always been me. And I think it's really hard. The Israelites found it really hard. The book of Judges is a repeating cycle of good times where the Israelites forget all about God and just start worshipping other gods and basically getting a bit cocky, and then it all goes wrong, and then they cry out to God and he is merciful and he rescues them, and then they forget all about him again. And when we're comfortable, it's really, really easy to forget who is behind it all and being dependent on him. But that is what he's commanding us to here. So what does that look like? How do we be dependent on God when life is comfortable or when it's not? Well, the most obvious one is money, and preachers will always jump to that, and I am not going to be an exception because I think it's exactly what the passage says. If anything is clear, we should not rely on our prosperity, and it is one of the things we are most tempted to rely on if we are fortunate enough to be prosperous. And that is insidious. It slowly grips our hearts, and we subconsciously rise to a different expectation of what our life should look like, what standard of living we should have, whatever the standard is. And depending on how wealthy you are, it's very different. But God says, no, give to me first, the first fruits and the best, not what's left when you've chosen your standard of living. So if your security, if you're honest, lies in knowing you have a healthy bank balance, I have one piece of advice. Give some away today. Go home and give some away. And then if you don't already, plan to give some away every month. An amount that makes an impact on your life. Give it to the church, give it to charities that do stuff that you think is important. And every time you see it go out of your bank account each month, offer it to God and say, please take this, use this. I depend on you, not on this. I think this gets harder as we get older and often more well off. When we were first married, I started training for ordination, and that meant that we'd been two single people with two incomes, and we both gave away money each month, and suddenly I was going to have no income, and we were like, what do we do about our giving? Because I give this away and you give that away, what should we do? And I kind of did the sums, and it didn't add up. If we carried on giving away the money at the same rate that we were giving it, there just wasn't going to be enough to make ends meet and to cover our costs. And we went to church, and I'm assuming the sermon was about giving, I can't actually remember, and we both came out of the service and independently both felt that God had told us we had to carry on giving away what we'd already been giving away and not reduce it, which was quite scary as quite a young married couple, not really sure whether we were going to manage the costs of running a house and all of that. And but we felt that we should, so we decided we would. And the next day, an envelope got pushed through our door, and it was from friends of ours who knew that I was starting training, and it was a cheque for £1,000. And this does not happen to me often, but in fact, that's the only time. and it just felt like God was going, see, if you put me first and you trust me, I will provide. And somehow or other, we didn't get into debt, and there was enough money. And I don't really know how that happened, other than God did provide what we needed. But definitely, as you get older and you get more responsibilities, it gets harder to keep that radical, okay, we'll just do what God asks. So I would encourage myself as much as anyone else to go, let's give it away and let's rely on God, not on what we have. And some of us, that may not be our problem. Our problem may be the challenge is that there isn't, it doesn't feel like there is enough, and it's the worry about money. And whether we have a lot or a little, I would say we all need to hear from this passage. Go to God first, trust him to provide what we need, and see how he honours that trust. But money is not the only thing. Time, when God says rest on the Sabbath, it's not lie in bed all day. It's a holy Sabbath to God. We need to give our time to God weekly, and in fact daily, stopping to pray, making that a priority. And again, I have to be honest, preparing this sermon, I feel like I've been challenged on every level. Because I think that's really hard. I find it hard in this 24/7 world. The moment you wake up, there's emails, more emails than I know what to do with, and there's a whole lot of jobs I probably should have done yesterday and I haven't got to, and you can just get into a quickly frenetic activity instead of trusting that God will provide the right amount of time to do everything that needs to be done and stopping and coming to him. And so if you're like me thinking, yeah, I'm not really giving my time to God, I'd encourage you to just go, okay, the first thing I do when I get out of bed, the first fruits of my day, to just make time for God. And I think this is linked to another thing that we can often get tempted to lean on, which is our own abilities. You know, the Israelite farmers depended on their ability to grow crops well, to tend animals well, and the better they were at that, the better they would probably do. By stopping once a week and for all these festivals and spending time with God, they were putting God above that. And I was thinking about this when I was like kind of in my teens and early 20s. I didn't really have a lot of confidence in my abilities, and I did pray a lot and depend a lot on God, and I'd gone through a really difficult time, and it kind of left me quite bruised, and I didn't feel like I had much to offer. And God has been incredibly gracious and helped me, restored me, and brought me to a place where I feel safe and secure and more confident in my abilities. And the danger then, of course, is that I start to rely on those and go, oh yeah, I'm pretty good at this, I can do life, forgetting that the only reason I'm where I am is because of what he's done for me. So how do we stop these things taking the wrong place in our lives? How do we depend on God? By stopping, giving time to God regularly and often. It's why we celebrate communion, because we forget so easily who God is and what he's done for us. By recognizing that everything we have is from him and giving back to him, giving back through money and through time. If you're thinking, oh yes, I do need to do something with this, the 24/7 prayer week would be a great place to start. Give up an hour, more than an hour, and take an hour out of your day, your week, and stop and come to God. Sign up for it. We need to make choices to remember who God is and how much we need him on a daily basis. So these commandments show us God's provision. They show us that we need to depend on him. But they're not. It doesn't actually stop there. I've already read that page. You'll be glad to hear. These chapters in Leviticus, and in fact, much of Leviticus, and it's been mentioned before, they point to God's ultimate plan. Jesus is the true Sabbath. He says, come to me, you who are weary, and I will give you rest. I haven't touched on the Passover bit much this morning because we have already looked at the Day of Atonement, but Jesus is the Passover lamb whose sacrifice means that God passes over our sin and doesn't punish it like he should. Jesus is the Jubilee. At the beginning of his ministry in Luke's Gospel, he stands up, and he reads out some verses from Isaiah 61, and this is what he reads. The Lord has anointed me to preach good news to the poor, freedom for the prisoners, release the oppressed, and proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. And all of the commentaries that I've come across agree that the year of the Lord's favor refers to this Jubilee. It sounds like it. Freedom for the prisoners, release for the oppressed, good news for the poor. Jesus stood there and said, I'm here. The Jubilee is here. God's favor is here. It's me. There's a fantastic Christian singer from quite a way back, but if you haven't ever listened to him, I'd really recommend Michael Card, The Beginning. You can find it on most music platforms. And one of his songs is called The Jubilee. And I'm not going to do it, Tim. I'm not going to sing it. But this is just a part of it, which I find really moving. So apologies now if I tear up. The Lord provided for a time for the slaves to be set free, for the debts to all be cancelled, so his chosen ones could see. His deep desire was for forgiveness. He longed to see their liberty. And his yearning was embodied in the year of Jubilee. And then the chorus says, and think about us as we stand before God. It says this, debts forgiven, slaves set free. Jesus is our Jubilee. And for me, this is why it can't ever be a shallow prosperity gospel. Because all of this is not pointing to, this is not the end in Leviticus. It's pointing to the deeper spiritual reality that Jesus is our Jubilee. We just sang it. There is no more for heaven now to give. It's all in Jesus. And you may this morning be, you may have walked in reveling in that joy, knowing that you depend on God. And you may be there. Or you may, like me, be thinking, I'm quite a long way from where I need to be. That other things have crept in, become either more important to you than God, or just taken his place as the thing that you rely on. And if that is us, this is for us. Our sins are forgiven. The fact that we've done it is forgiven. Our debts are forgiven. We are set free. We can always come to Jesus. We don't have to wait 50 years for the year of Jubilee. It's every day on offer. We can come and ask him to set us free. Ask him to be the centre of our lives again. And just thank him for the sacrifice that he has made that even makes that possible. And knowing that we have all the joy of heaven before us. That's the Jubilee. And that, to me, is the biggest message of Leviticus. Is God is pointing forward to Jesus. Amen.